Thank you. And let me thank the organizers for inviting me both to this conference and to this very nice program that's going on around it. So what I want to talk about today is work that has been going on for a while already with Ines Aniceto and Ricardo Schiappa, who are both here, where our goal is to get a full understanding of the physics and mathematics that's encoded in these resurgent asymptotic trend series that have popped up a few times already. And what I mean by full will hopefully become clear as I go along. And let me mention that this is work that's about to appear on average 2.2 papers we expect, which hopefully will appear in the next few months. And this talk also goes together with Ines's talk that she will give after this. So here's an outline of what I'm planning to talk to you about. So the main subject of what I want to say is the Penove 1 equation. So I want to start by motivating, both from the physics and the mathematics point of view, why you should be interested in this Penove 1 equation. And then I want to discuss some properties. And I want to solve this first formally in a trend series solution. But then the main content of the talk is about how to take this trend series solution and get actual interesting physical information from it. And this goes under the name, we dubbed it analytic trend series summation. And you can do this in different ways, and I'll describe two of these ways. In most of my talk, even though Penove 1 is a second order ODE, and so it has two integration constants, I will set one of the constants to zero, but actually the fact that we can deal with the second constant is an important result from our research. So that's what I want to end with, and then I'll conclude and have some open questions. But let's start with some motivation. So Penove 1 popped up in physics already, a long time ago, and an important application started 25 years ago with work by several authors, among which David Gross from here. And it appears in string theory, in simple string theories as candidates for quantum gravity. And so if you're interested in quantum gravity and in string theories, you might ask, what's the simplest string theory you can study? And in the 90s, it was discovered that one very simple way to study string theories is by discretizing their world sheet and studying matrix models. And the Feynman diagrams of the matrix models then organize themselves into the string world sheets. And so that says something about the world sheet, but then you might wonder, well, what's the target space related to all of this? Where do the strings live? And that depends a bit on the actual matrix model you study. So one thing to realize is that the size of the matrix model, 1 over the size of the matrix model, 1 over n, is related to the string coupling constant in this description. So in all that I'm going to be saying, we'll be interested in looking at a large n expansion. Now, if you would take a strict large n limit in these models, then you would just get 3-level strings, so you would only get the genus 0 world sheet theory. But you can do much more. It was found that you can actually take double scaling limits, where you not only take this n to infinity, but you also take certain couplings in your matrix model to specific values at the same time. And then you actually recover full string theories. And the simplest case that I'll be interested in is coupling this to a certain minimal CFT that's called the 2.3 minimal model. And then you'll find a very simple string theory in zero target space dimensions. And what people found in the 90s is that you can actually calculate the partition function. And it turns out to be related to a very simple function u of one parameter z. So this z essentially is the string coupling constant. I'll tell you how it's related exactly in a moment. But the important thing for now is that what people found then is an expansion of this function u in a negative power of z. So again, we're interested in a large z expansion. This negative power of z is like the string coupling, and so we want to expand around large z. And of course, the punchline of this story is that it was found that this function u of z actually satisfies the Penove 1 ODE, at least its asymptotic expansion. But note the word asymptotic here. We don't really have a function yet at this point. We really have an asymptotic expansion that we want to turn into a function somehow. So the main question is, can we sum this into an actual function? And what does that function tell us physically and mathematically? So in this talk, I'll be focusing on Penove 1. After my talk, Ines will sort of go off criticality and really look at the full matrix model. So that's the physics side of the motivation. Now, also in mathematics, of course, this story is very old. Penove started studying his equations more than 100 years ago. And what Penove was looking at was second order ordinary differential equations. whose movable singularities are poles. And what does that mean? Well, a differential equation can have poles because there are, or can have singularities because there's a singularity in the equation itself, and then it will always sit there. But it can also have singularities because you choose specific boundary conditions. And then if you change the boundary conditions, the locations of these singularities might change. So here you see an example. This is a Penleve 1 solution where I change boundary conditions. The white dots are poles, and you see that they move around. So these are these movable poles. And Penleve was interested in the situation where all movable singularities are actually poles. And he and his the people that followed him in the end found 6 classes, and these are now known as Penleve transcendents. And we're interested in the simplest one, the Penleve 1 case. And these have been studied, like I said, for 100 years. Boutroux was one of the first to really study its solution. And he found a classification of the solutions of this Penleve 1 equation, depending on what these poles do. So in general, there will be lots of poles all throughout the complex Z-plane, and the generic solutions will have poles everywhere in the plane. But like I said, Penleve 1 is a second-order ODE. It has 2 integration constants. And you might like to look at subfamilies of these solutions. And Boutroux found that there are 1-parameter subfamilies that he called truncated solutions, that actually have 2 empty sectors. So you can divide the complex plane into 5 regions. I'll show you why 5 in a moment. There's a Z5 symmetry. And when you look at specific 1-parameter subfamilies, you have 2 empty quintants. And if you, within that 1-parameter subfamily, actually tune your other parameter to specific values, you find what he called the tritronqué solution, which has poles only in 1 quintant of the plane. And so as a mathematician, you might ask, well, on the one hand, you can try to formally solve Penleve 1. On the other hand, you can actually numerically find plots like this. And how do these relate? So that's another aspect of the questions we're interested in. So let me tell you a bit more about this Penleve 1 equation. So here it is in our notations. It's a nonlinear equation. There's a square here. It's a second order ODE. And there's 1 complex parameter, or 1 complex variable, Z. And if you take the back of an envelope and do a quick calculation, then you see that if you rescale Z by this Z5 shift, and you rescale U by the Z5 shift, you get back your original equation. And so there's a Z5 symmetry here, and that's the Z5 symmetry that lies underneath these 5 sectors that I show you. Well, like I said, these solutions have many poles. And as a first exercise, you can try to find a series around such a pole. So you can make some ansatz where you start the series off by 1 over z minus z0 to some power. You can see that you can only do it if the power is 2. So they're all double poles. You can also find that the coefficient is always going to be 1. That's going to be important in a moment. And then you can just solve it further. And of course, at some point, you're going to find another arbitrary coefficient, because Penleve 1 should have 2 parameters, and one is the location of a single pole, and the other one happens to pop up at fourth order, and after that, the whole series is fixed. And like I said, generically, you will find infinitely many of these poles. Now, in physics, to go back to the physics interpretation of these solutions, this U is not the partition function of this 2D quantum gravity. Actually, if you write the partition function of this 2D quantum gravity as e to the power free energy, and then you take minus the second derivative of this free energy, then you get this U. So the U is something like the specific heat of the theory. And now let me come back to this coefficient 1 here. If you go through these equations, then you see that if U has a double pole of with coefficient 1, then F will have a logarithm branch cut with coefficient 1. And so Z will have a 0, right? It's e to the log Z. And so it has a single zero. So everywhere where U has a double pole, Z will have a single zero, and that will be important in the things we want to study later. And then the final property I want to mention again is that there are these types of solutions, the general one, the tronqué one, and the tritronqué one. So now let's do what we're here for at this resurgence conference, and let's try to make an asymptotic solution of this Penleve 1 equation. And this has been done. You actually should put in again the 2 parameters, and this was first realized by Garofalides, Itzkapayev, and Marinho, and then we worked it out in a paper in 2011 for a full 2-parameter trans-series solution. So I think most of the people here know what a trans-series is, but just to set terminology, a trans-series is a multiple series expansion. Marcos showed some examples earlier, where you have different trans monomials, so different blocks that you expand in. So you have a regular x, that's your normal series expansion, but then you would like to expand in, for example, e to the minus a over x as well. And these things come with a natural ordering. For example, e to the minus a over x, when x goes to 0, would be much smaller than x. And just as a remark on notation, I'll be going back and forth between different names for the same thing. So x will be what I call the string coupling. But there's also this z, and remember that z to a specific power then is equal to x. And the question I want to look at is, first of all, how do we sum such a trans-series expansion into an actual function? And then, of course, what is the underlying physics and mathematics? So let's start by doing the most naive thing that we can, and just try to write a series expansion. Now, if you look at this Penleve-1 equation, it has a u squared on the one side, it has a z on the other side. So you might guess that if you don't have poles, then u goes like square root of z. And indeed, in these empty regions, u behaves like square root of z. And then you can try to make a large z expansion around that. And if you do that, you will find this answer. And you can go as much as you like, as far as you like, into the coefficients. Note that the expansion here is in z to the minus 5 over 2. You might remember that the string coupling was z to the minus 5 over 4. So this is actually a GS squared expansion. So this is something like a closed string theory. And the coefficients grow very fast. They grow double factorially. And so you cannot just plug in a number for z and find an answer, because at some point the terms will diverge. And also, in this perturbative solution, there were no free parameters yet, so you have to do more. And the first thing you might try to do is indeed make a trans series. Take this extra block, this extra trans monomial e to the minus a over x, expand in that guy as well. And you can do that, and you will find that now you have one free parameter. So you can multiply every instanton, or d-brain it will be in this terminology, by a power of sigma. And then you can play with sigma, and all of these, for any sigma, you will find a solution. So this provides a one parameter family. But there should be a second one, right? Because once again, it's a second order ODE. Actually, if you try to solve the one parameter case, you will find that not only for a positive value of the instanton action you can solve it, but also for the exact same negative value. And you can also see this in the Borel plane. So if you do the Borel transform of this perturbative series, then you will find two branch cuts starting at exactly these values of A. So there are all kinds of hints that you should use a two-parameter trans series solution. And this can be done. It takes some work, but you can actually solve this with a two-parameter trans series solution. And this is the full answer that we found in 2011. And it looks a bit ugly, but let me go through some of the properties of this, and it'll start showing its beauty. So first of all, there are now several trans monomials sitting in here. So there's the x that we started with. There's the e to the minus x, but now also the e to the plus x. And then sort of a nuisance is that there's also a log x that you have to expand in. Now this log x, it's more irritating than useful, because it doesn't come with undetermined coefficients. Its coefficients are all determined if you know the powers of log x to the power 0. So what I'll do in the rest of this talk is essentially completely ignore this function lmn, just set it to 1, and keeping in the back of my mind that I'm cheating, but that I can always uncheat and redo this. And then, of course, the most important remark maybe is that there are these two parameters now, sigma 1 and sigma 2. So the e to the minus a is multiplied by a sigma 1, and the e to the plus a over x is multiplied by a sigma 2. The logs, like I said, I will ignore. What I will definitely not ignore is this little factor in front of here. So the phis are all asymptotic series. Those are the perturbation series around several numbers of d-brains. And in my convention, I start all of these sums at g equals 0. So they start with a constant term. But that is because I've sort of pulled out the power of x already. So in every sector of n e to the minus a contributions and m e to the plus a contributions, there's an overall leading power x to the beta nm. And these leading powers will play a crucial role in what I will have to say. So already giving away a bit of the punchline, if you will go through everything that I'm going to tell you and you will find a way to sum these trans series, then there's a nice map between the solutions that Boutroux found and the parameters that are sitting in the trans series. Actually, if you set both of your parameters to 0, you will find back the tree tronquet. If you take one parameter subfamilies, where you set sigma 2 equals 0, for example, you will find the tronquets, and only for full two-parameter solutions, you will find the generic solutions. You might ask, what if I do this in the matrix model, not in the plan of A1 equation, and Inês will tell you a lot about that in her talk after this. So now let's get to going from a formal trans series into actually something that you can compute. And there's an old way to do this, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it because it's actually the way that we do not want to use. And so this is this way to do it is the Borel-Ecal summation, the Borel-Padé-Ecal summation if you do Padé approximants in between. And the idea of it is that you take your trans series. This is the same expression except that now I took out these logs, as I said I would do. And you look at all the asymptotic series in your string coupling or in your parameter X, and you Borel sum those. And if you then, like I said, take a Padé approximant in between to actually do the Borel summation, that's what's called Borel-Padé-Ecal. And then you do the other sums, so the sums over N and M, sums over non-perturbative contribution, just order by order. And a lot of the times you find that these are actually convergent sums, but even if you don't, then you can do some sort of optimal truncation, and so you can get numbers out of this. Now let me make a couple of remarks about this procedure, which hopefully explain why this is not what I want to do today. First of all, note there's often this remark that people say, well, a to the plus a over x is something that blows up if I make x small. So how could you even expand in this guy when it's very big? Well, if you're really just doing numerical physics, note that it's always multiplied by a sigma 2. So if you give me a value of x, then I can always choose a very small value of sigma 2, so that this combination is still small, and I can still sum it reasonably well numerically. But this does, of course, restrict you to very small values of sigma 2. So doing these methods, you cannot just go arbitrarily far in sigma 2 parameter space. And even for sigma 1, there's some place where you have to stop just because the combination becomes of order 1. So that's one problem with this way to sum things. A related problem is that at some point the actual transmonomials might become of the same order. So e to the minus a over x, if I take x to be imaginary, becomes of order 1, and the expansion in that might become of the same order as the expansion in x. And so then also this order of summing things might not be the best way to do. So mathematically this happens when you encounter an anti-Stokes line. In physics it means that some sort of brain effect becomes of the same order as your perturbative effect, and so you might have a phase transition going on here. And so all of this begs the question, can we do better than this Borel-Ecal summation? And we can. So let's now really start look at the starting orders of the different asymptotic series that we have here. So here I plotted them for sectors with labels N and M, N contributions of e to the minus a over x, M contributions of e to the plus a over x, and the numbers in the table are the orders that the asymptotic series starts at. And you see a clear pattern here, right? It glows linearly, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and also higher up, things grow linearly. Now to study this even better, let me now set the second parameter to 0. So I'll set sigma 2 to 0 now, which means that all the higher M contributions have a 0 factor in front of them, so I'm really interested in the lowest row here. And then I can draw the same situation like this. So now note that I'm plotting N here in the horizontal direction, but I'm plotting the actual coefficients of U of the N0 sector in the vertical direction. And so here you see the same thing. At 0, it starts at 0. At 1, it starts at 1. At 2, it starts at 2, and so on. So I'll be using both of these plots. I guess the mnemonic is whenever you see red, blue, and green, I'm talking about N and M. And whenever you see only green appearing, I've set sigma 2 to 0, and I'm talking about plots like this. And so in this type of plot, Borel-Padé-Ecal is just summing vertically, summing the entire perturbative series, asymptotic series, in a single sector. But now from this picture, you might ask, well, why not do this? Why not take the first sum of every sector, the first term of every sector, and sum these? And the amazing thing is that you can sum these guys first, and you actually find an exact answer. And this was found by Ovidio Kostin and his collaborators started in 95, and it's a long, ongoing project. And he calls this trans-asymptotic summation. And what Ovidio and collaborators found was that if you do this exact sum that I just told you, then you get this very simple expression, where tau now is the e to the minus a over x factor, but dressed with an extra power of x. And so you get a very simple exact answer. And one thing you immediately see of this answer is that you now get information about these poles, right? There's a 1 over tau in the denominator, and so tau equals 1 tells you something about the poles of your Penleve 1 function. This looks like one pole, tau equals 1, but note that this is a very multivalued function, the inverse of this, it's the Lambert W function, just like if I would invert it without this here, I would get a logarithm which has branch cuts. And so you get a whole array of poles. So this is already a step forward. If you were just to sum your transseries, then I guess I could show that like this. The transseries just brute force summing it would see this. But now by doing this asymptotic summation, you see a little bit more. You see the first series of poles. And then you can ask, can I go further? Can I now look at the GS corrections, the string coupling constant corrections? And you can do that. And you can go to the third line and the fourth line and so on. And so you would get corrections to the locations of these poles. Note that here I've slightly changed my blocks, my transmonomials, because tau now has an extra power of square root of x in it, but the ordering remains the same. So Ovidio and his collaborators showed that you can actually do this next order, and like I said, you get GS corrections. But when you do this, and we started playing with this, it becomes clear that you should do something else instead. This whole computation becomes much easier if you look at the partition function, capital Z, instead of the U that I've been talking about for now. So now let's look at this Z. So I draw the same diagram here. I draw the starting orders of now the transseries for the partition function. And now you see a very different growth. Now the growth is quadratic. And again, let me do the same thing. Just set sigma 2 equals 0 for now and look at this bottom block. And so then you get this picture. Where now at 0 it starts at 0, at 1 it starts at 1, but then at 2 it starts at 4, and so on. If you were to do the same thing now, your computation becomes a lot easier. Because again, if I try to sum the first diagonal, then I only have to sum two terms. And these two terms exactly give you 1 and minus tau. And so where you first found poles at tau equals 1, you now very trivially find zeros at tau equals 1. And you might do the same thing. So you might start doing GS corrections, GS squared corrections, and so on. Well, at GS corrections, you're not going to find so much new information. You're going to find corrections to the locations of your pole. But then at the next order, you see something special happening, because now you will get a quadratic polynomial in tau. And a quadratic polynomial, as we all know, has two solutions. So you're not just going to find tau equals 1 plus corrections, you're going to find a new solution. So one of these solutions is going to be new, if you start doing it here. And it turns out that this location scales as 1 over GS. And you can ask, where does these new poles sit in the complex plane? And the answer is not that hard to guess. So this was what the perturbative or the non-summed solution saw. And now you get a second line of poles, and it's exactly this second line of poles that you see here. So you're increasing the amount of stuff that your summation sees. And you can do third order, and you get the next line of poles, and so on. So maybe to show this in another picture, if I were just to do the very simplest transasymptotic summation, I would get tau equals 1. Then if I do the next line here, I would get GS correction, but once I get here, I get the leading contribution to a next pole, and then I can start summing up again, and nothing interesting will happen until I reach this arrow. So I'll get some corrections, and then at some point I reach the next arrow, and I get the location of the next line, and so on. But now you might ask, okay, why aren't you listening to what the problem is telling you? Why are you summing still diagonally when there's clearly a parabola sitting in here? So why sum linearly? Why not sum quadratically? And this is what we call quadratic analytic transseries summation. And you can do it again. You can find exact expressions. So that's the nice thing about this problem. If you treat it in the right way, you get exact expressions for your sum. And so this is what you find if you now do this quadratic sum of all the leading orders. you get a sum which has, so zeta here is essentially again e to the minus a over x. Q is actually square root of x, so it's related to x. And then you get a very simple expansion, q to the n squared zeta to the n, multiplied by Barnes functions. So the Barnes function, for those who might not remember, is this super factorial thing. So the Barnes function of n plus 1 is the product of the first n factorials. And this is not a new result. People have been looking at these quadratic summations a lot before. The particular result I mentioned was already found by Marinho, Schiappa, and Weiss in 2008. People have also been doing this in the matrix model and found theta function expansions there. Of course, the thing that I showed you looked a lot like a theta function. And so this has already attracted some attention before. And from the fact that I already mentioned the theta function, you might think, well, there might be a relation to modularity. I'll have a bit more to say about that in my conclusions. The nice thing about looking at the problem from this point of view is that now it becomes very easy to also include the second parameter. So I'll tell you about that in a moment. But first, let's stay with the first parameter for just another. So what I showed you now was the leading order in GS, and you can again do higher order and higher order. And the philosophy here is that you temporarily introduce the new transmonomial q, it goes like square root of x, so you still have your old x, you have square root of x, and you have this e to the minus a over x, which we encoded in zeta. And then you just do a clever thing, you put some terms in here, and you put the next terms in there, and the next terms in there. And then you exactly sum these z0, z1, and so on, so that you end up with a series where your only remaining parameter that appears in a series is this x, and everything else you've done exactly, and that's why we dubbed this analytic transseries summation. And the nice thing now is that you could do the zeroth order analytic transseries summation, so really that very simple function that I've shown you here, and look for its zeros, and in one go you'll find all of the poles now. So where you had to work very hard earlier on, do a next order computation to get the next array of poles, you now get all of them in one go. I have to make some small print comment here. I said that this z-plane is divided into 5 sectors. The 5th sector that's to the left here, actually you would have to do a Stokes transition as well to really find the poles there, and Ines will tell you much more about that, about how to do that. So in the same picture, whereas we first found these diagonal contributions, now if you do zeroth order you get the location of the poles, of all the arrays of poles, just at once. And then everything you do after that is just GS corrections. Okay, so in the final few minutes, what about this second parameter? So let me first go back to the one parameter case once more. This was the answer we found at zeroth order. And again, Marinho, Schiappa, and Weiss also looked at what happens at higher order in GS for the one parameter case. And they found that the corrections are very simple. So at first order in the string coupling constant, you just get a polynomial in your expression. The next order you get another polynomial of degree 6, and well, the expressions look a bit ugly, but you can compute them, and it's not too hard to compute them. So you get a nice and simple structure. Actually, it turns out that now when we turn on sigma 2, you still get a very simple structure. So let's now look at the sigma 2 to the power 1 solution. So let's do analytic transseries summation on the second row. And again, you find something that looks in the same form, but corrected by function phi n. And phi n now is no longer a polynomial, it's this function. You can write it in many different ways. You can write it as a sum of harmonic numbers, you can write it in terms of the digamma function if you want. This might look a bit ugly, but this will actually generalize to higher orders, so that's why I wrote it here as well. And then at higher orders in GS, in the string coupling, you will find corrections that are determined by exactly the same polynomials p1, p2, and so on that I showed you on the last slide. So the structure looks very similar. And this continues at order GS to the power 2, for example, you find another function, which you can now express in terms of the digamma and the next polygamma, so the trigamma, I guess that would be called. And so you find expressions that have a very clear structure in them. And actually, if you look at these expressions for a little bit, you see that they resemble what mathematicians call derivation. So there's some kind of Leibniz rule going on here. For example, if you think of phi 2 as a second derivative of this first, this Barnes function, then of course the next order would be the second derivative of phi 2 times p1. And so you would indeed get phi 2 times p1, phi 1 times p1 prime, and 1/2 p1 double prime. So there's some derivation sitting behind all of this. So it appears, just like is the case for GS corrections, that you can add a single enhanced instanton, a single e to the plus a over x factor by asking, acting with a derivation. And if you act n times divide by 1 over n factorial, you'll get the n e to the plus a correction contribution. And so as a result, in a cartoon version of the full partition function, and now I really mean full, you can just act with e to the power this delta on the sigma 2 equals 0 solution. Now, of course, that gives you the green part here, so then you have to do the red part, which you can use exactly the same techniques for. You multiply it by the diagonal part, and that should really be a functional representation of the full Penleve 1 solution. So, to conclude, we've seen that problems, and I've been telling you about Penleve 1, Ines will tell you about matrix models, but we think this approach is much more general, that problems become very tractable when we use the correct analytic transseries summation. Now here that's a quadratic one, in other problems it might be a linear one or even another one. And if you do that, you can take this transseries that's just turning the crank and that a machine gives you, and you can turn it, you can sum the full transseries in this way, for all the parameters. And as a particular application of why this is so nice, I showed you that you can now get all of the zeros of this Penleve 1 solution just in one go. And so in physics terms, that means that we can now easily study phase transitions, right? This is where the instantons or the D-brains become of order 1. And so there's a phase transition going on here that you can study. And Ines will show you much more about these phase transitions. So as an outlook, what would we want to do next? Well, Marcus and Alba this morning already said a lot about the topological string. It would, of course, be very nice to do this in a topological string setting based on this holomorphic anomaly equation and these spectral theory that was discussed this morning. So to sort of relate our approach to their approach, we don't have a non-perturbative definition. We don't start from a spectral system. But we get a whole family of solutions. So we can do this for arbitrary value of sigma 1 and sigma 2. And then a clever physicist should tell me, well, the particular problem I'm interested in has this value of sigma 1, that value of sigma 2. So we start from a transseries and we turn it into a function for undetermined sigma I. So you could call this with a play on Marcus' title that we recode the semi-classics. Modularity, I don't have much to say about it at this point, but it's clear that this looks a lot, well, first of all, like a theta function if I remove this, but also this whole function looks very modular. There might be one problem, which is that these coefficients grow very fast, but q to the n squared also can become small very fast. So for small q, you can actually sum this function. You can look at these zeros, and just like the zeros of a theta function have a particular pattern, these zeros also have a particular pattern. So there are a lot of questions here to be answered by mathematicians. And then some other open questions. Of course, question number one is, can we extend this to matrix models? And Ines will tell you that this can definitely be done. I haven't told you much about this diagonal sector, this blue sector. You can just sum it by hand if you want, but of course the philosophy is that we want to do something smarter. And so you might ask, can I write this also as e to the power sum derivation on z perturbative? And then finally, a bit more highbrow question is, could we classify problems in this way? So here we saw a problem where quadratic is the way to go. You might find other problems where linear is the way to go, and there might be cases where cubic or some even more complicated summation technique is the way to go. So can you maybe classify problems in this way? So that's where I would like to end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
A quick comment, and then I have a question. So this is, I mean, really beautiful. The comment is probably you can only use this approach if you have an integrable model to get a partition function and do transasymptotics in this way.
Right.
The question is, can you uniformly cover the pole sector? Because if so, one can come up with a really streamlined sort of calculation of the Stokes constant in closed form based on this, you know,
right,
that we have.
Yeah, so before I answer that question about the remark, I think what you're saying is true. There has to be something special going on to find this exact quadratic summation, whether that's integrability or modularity or whatever, I don't know. But that's exactly this classification problem. When can you do that? And then, what did you ask second?
If you can.
If I can go through the yes. So unfortunately, at this point, the story is the other way around. Hence the small print that I showed you somewhere. I'll just point at the picture. What we can do right now is this whole sector. I don't know if you can see the red line, but the lower left sector and the upper left sector. And then we actually have to do a Stokes transition before we can get into this fifth sector. So you cannot read off all the Stokes constants yet. We have to calculate the Stokes constants and then put that in to find the locations of the poles here. We would love to do it the other way around, of course, but at this point we don't have a way yet.
Yeah. So can you extend this to plane level 2? Is there some sort of zeros as well, or?
I think you should be able to do exactly the same thing for plane level 2. So there, the tree tronqué would be the Hastings-McLeod and so on. There is a trans-series there. There are poles there that are first order now. And actually, if you, what Inesh will show is that you can lift this up to the whole matrix model setting. And then, of course, you can take two double scaling limits, either to plane level 1 or to plane level 2. And then a very good question would be this modular types of objects that you find on the one side and on the other side, how are they related? My hope would be by some modular transformation, but that's just a very wild guess.
I have two questions, if nobody else. Okay, so the first question is probably very easy. So you mentioned phase transitions. Do you know what order the phase transitions are? Are they first order, second order, something else?
I wouldn't know by heart. I guess you can calculate. But the reason that we haven't really looked at this particular phase transition is that there's, as far as we know, not really a physical interpretation for it. Because the phase transition appears right here. And so it appears for a complex value of your coupling constant. So the actual phase transition you probably wouldn't see in 2D string theory, or at least wouldn't have an interpretation. And that's why we didn't study it in much detail. So,
thank you. And then the other question is, you mentioned some possible modularity properties of one of the functions you were discussing. So quite often with modular functions, they have a sort of natural boundaries in their Q, in terms of their either tau variable or Q variable in the unit disk, they're okay. And then right on the disk, something bad happens.
Yeah.
So would you expect resurgence to work across such things? Maybe. Would you be able to extend across the boundary?
That's something I've been
boundary?
Playing with a little bit. So this function, I'm calling it an analytic function, but I cannot tell you a closed form for the sum to infinity. So right. To actually get values for this function, you have to plug in numerical values for Q and or zeta.
Right.
Then you can do a stupid thing, which is the sum. Think of zeta as a variable, and then you get into the problem that these coefficients grow really fast, and the radius of convergence is zero. If you take this as a variable, actually, a small parameter to the n squared grows exactly the same as the Barnes function, or becomes smaller exactly the same rate as the Barnes function becomes larger. So then you can start doing Borel summation. So if you really want to compute this, you actually use Borel summation.
Right, but
and maybe you could indeed apply some. Well, I'm not sure if it would be resurgence to this series, because things don't grow factorially here, but they grow as Barnes numbers. So a mathematician would have to come up with some.
So I guess what I'm asking about is typically functions like this are very difficult to continue through the disk at Q equals 1,
yeah.
The circle at Q equals 1, because there's a natural boundary
right.
in the function. So
I'm expecting the same thing here.
And
that's why I would love to have a modular interpretation of this where someone tells me, well, if you send now tau, so Q is e to the tau, essentially. If you now send tau to 1 over tau, then this is what you have to do. But I don't have anything beyond wild guesses at this point.
What do you mean by generalizing this to matrix models? Do you mean higher points of 2D gravity?
No, so we don't take any scaling. Inesh will tell you a lot about that in the next talk, but we don't take any scaling limits there. So it's really the full matrix model, which is a function of the size of the matrix and GS or some parameter in your action. And so for any value of these parameters, we can write down a transseries, which now will not have numbers like Penleve 1 has numbers in the transseries, but will have functions. So this is what mathematicians call parametric research.
For any polynomial potential?
For, in principle, we've done it for the quadratic potential. But in principle, you can do it for
several instantons.
I'm sorry?
When you have several kinds of instantons,
then
only one.
It would technically become more complicated, but I think that it could still be done. Yeah.
Other questions? Just out of curiosity, you mentioned in the conclusions an open problem to find a closed form for the zero of G2. Is that? No.
The zero. Sorry?
In the conclusions before.
Here.
Ah, yes. The closed form.
Yeah. So it looks like, so for a theta function, if someone asks you where are the zeros of a theta function, there, then there's an expression that if you look at zeta as the variable, then they're in a lattice, right? They're the exact lattice of your torus, original torus. Here you find that the zeros of this thing do not lie in a lattice, but it lies in a sort of scaled lattice. So there's a line of zeros, then there's a line of zeros at distance 1, then at 1/2, 1/3, and so on. So I don't have an exact closed formula for that yet, but I think it can be done, and you can find the location of the exact zeros. And of course, if you know analytically the zeros of a function, of a holomorphic function, then you know essentially everything.
Thanks. So, no further questions or comments? So, thank you again.
Thank you.